Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, we hear from analysts about changes in the world relationship with Iran. Democrats react to Iran and clash over domestic issues in a fourth debate. Do our Stone Age brains let us get duped by political candidates?
When we see somebody on TV, we don't really know them at all. We're just catching a glimpse of them. But our brain convinces us that, oh, we really know this guy.
And using music in the battle to help refugees. It's right here on The Voice of America. The head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Yukiya Amano, is in Tehran for talks on Iran's future compliance with the internationally agreed nuclear agreement, a day after the presidents of the United States and Iran hailed the UN Atomic Watchdog Agency's assessment that it has complied with its obligations. Iranian President Hassan Rouhani, speaking through an interpreter, hailed the announcement Sunday as historic in the political and economic history of Iran.
Today is the day of the victory of the people of Iran on the political arena. The people of Iran proved that constructive interaction is true and is the right way. We can have interactions with the world that is in the interest of our people and definitely not to the detriment of others. So as of today, it's clear that our country has a big power called the power of diplomacy.
Mr. Rouhani expected the result of sanctions relief to translate into annual growth of 5%, and he hoped the nuclear deal could serve as a model for the settlement of other regional issues. President Obama said Iran's compliance underscores what is possible with strong American diplomacy.
For decades, our differences with Iran meant that our governments almost never spoke to each other. Ultimately, that did not advance America's interests. Under the nuclear deal that we, our allies and partners, reached with Iran last year, Iran will not get its hands on a nuclear bomb. Engaging directly with the Iranian government on a sustained basis for the first time in decades has created a unique opportunity, a window, to try to resolve important issues.
Mr. Obama also announced a prisoner exchange, 5 Americans freed for 6 Iranian Americans and 1 Iranian awaiting trial on charges they violated U.S. trade sanctions, as well as resolution to a more than three-decade financial dispute. But the U.S. simultaneously imposed new sanctions on several individuals and companies with ties to Iran's ballistic missile program, a decision Iran Today denounced as illegitimate. Former U.S. diplomat and current adjunct professor Peter Bechtold of Portland State University tells VOA's Victor Beatty Sunday's announcement advanced world peace.
If you think of the alternative, endless confrontation doesn't work.
The removal of sanctions gives Iran access to funds ranging from $50 to $100 billion, according to senior administration officials. Are you concerned that they may turn this into its terrorist proxies?
I really don't think so. The accord that leads to the removal of sanctions, partial sanctions actually, was approved not just by the United States. This was not bilateral. It included Britain, France, Germany, China, and Russia. And all of these countries have a stake in fighting against terrorism because all of them have, in one way or another, to deal with this. The Iranian economy has been hurting under the sanctions, and there are some who argue that the increase in sanctions under the Obama administration has turned the screw so tightly that the Iranians were more likely to agree to the nuclear deal. So I don't think they're going to jeopardize this. The Iranians are not stupid. They are among the most clever people in the world, so clever that I sometimes worry about it. You know, their top priority is not to support Hezbollah or Hamas. Their top priority is to save Iran. And they've been very consistent about this. I think we've exaggerated their threat.
Peter Bechtold says Iran has been a regional power for more than 3,000 years, and Iran remains an important factor in resolving conflict in Iraq, Syria, and between Israel and the Palestinians. Regional analyst Stephen Zunes of the University of San Francisco says even Iran's ballistic missile program seems less of a threat as a result of its compliance with the nuclear deal.
Iran is still in violation of a number of UN Security Council resolutions which have called on that country to suspend the testing development of certain medium-range missiles. The threat, you know, from this development is certainly less so now that we know there is no possibility they can put nuclear warheads on it. Still, those resolutions are in effect, and there have been those who have been trying to get around them. And as a result, the Obama administration felt it important to make it clear that the nuclear agreement notwithstanding, the prisoner exchange notwithstanding, that this kind of behavior is unacceptable.
Is this a victory for moderates over hardliners in Iran?
Just as the nuclear agreement was a victory for moderates in the United States, it was also a victory for moderates in Iran. The international isolation that they have had to contend with for decades has really hurt the country. There's a new generation of Iranians who want to be part of increasingly globalized society, who are interested in being part of the international community, and having the government engage in the kinds of behaviors that have led to international sanctions and isolation, it was quite controversial. And more people were pushing for a change. By demonstrating that the economic problems and other issues can be dealt with better through a more moderate foreign policy, it'll certainly give the moderates higher standing among the Iranian people.
Apart from making Iran's foreign policy more aggressive, Stephen Zun says sanctions relief may give moderates a boost in efforts to improve Iran's image as a responsible neighbor. In social media, there is a lot of reaction to the lifting of the sanctions against Iran and its effect. Tiffany Hampton says Iran's sanctions lifted, good for diplomacy, bad for oil market. Reuters business headline reads, oil prices hit their lowest since 2003 as Iran sanctions lifted. And BBC News reports oil price fall below $28 a barrel as Iran sanctions lifted. The Los Angeles Times writes, as improved U.S.-Iran relations are celebrated, questions loom about the road ahead. On CNN Opinion, Majid Rafazadeh writes, Iran sanctions lifted. What it means to me. Will the lifting of sanctions mean that American and Iranian-American citizens can visit Iran, one of the oldest civilizations, without the fear of being detained? Will Iran and the U.S. open embassies in Washington and Tehran? Will many Iranians be able to visit the country of their dreams soon? Will the slogan, Death to America, finally be dropped? He adds, the response to these questions depends on the understanding of the interaction between Iran's hardliners and the moderates. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
A team of astronomers suggests that some good places to look for extraterrestrial intelligent life just might be in clusters of old stars. These more ancient stars don't have as much of the heavy elements that are needed to form planets as younger stars, such as our own sun. But the researchers say exoplanets have been found orbiting stars with only a tenth of the heavy elements of the sun. They say any planet capable of supporting life that formed around these old stars would have to orbit it closely. The close orbit could protect the planet and help it survive for perhaps billions of years. The researchers theorize that any life that did develop there could have had plenty of time to evolve, become more complex, and possibly develop intelligence. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
The Democratic U.S. presidential candidates met for a fourth debate Sunday night, clashing over U.S. domestic policy in an attempt to define their differences ahead of early voting. VOA's Katherine Gibson has details.
Former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders debated on what turned out to be a major day for President Barack Obama's foreign policy legacy. The candidates shared a cautious optimism on the exchange of prisoners and the completion of the Iran nuclear deal.
We've had one good day over 36 years, and I think we need more good days before we move more rapidly toward any kind of normalization.
Do I want to see that relationship become more positive in the future? Yes. Can I tell you that we should open an embassy in Tehran tomorrow? No, I don't think we should.
John Hudak of the Brookings Institution spoke to VOA via Skype about the impact on the presidential race.
Well, I think any day that the campaign talks about foreign policy is a good day for Secretary Clinton.
Clinton and Sanders are close in the polls in early voting states, but their differences came out sharply on domestic issues like gun control.
He has voted with the NRA, with the gun lobby, numerous times.
Sanders responded to the Clinton campaign's attacks on his health care proposals in recent days.
We're not going to tear up the Affordable Care Act. I helped write it.
And he attacked the Clinton campaign's ties to the financial industry.
I don't take money from big banks. I don't get personal speaking fees from Goldman Sachs.
The attack is a familiar one for Sanders, who has positioned his campaign as anti-establishment, while Clinton emphasized her experience and ties to President Obama.
I think as commander-in-chief, you've got to constantly be evaluating the decisions you have to make. I know a little bit about this, having spent many hours in the Situation Room advising President Obama.
We cannot keep talking past each other.
Former Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley, who was running a distant third to Clinton and Sanders, urged a spirit of cooperation in a divisive election. Online, two moments gained attention. Secretary Clinton's pause as she considered her relationship with Russian President Vladimir Putin.
It's interesting. It's
And Senator Sanders' refusal to attack Secretary Clinton's husband, former President Bill Clinton, for his past indiscretions.
I'm going to debate Secretary Clinton, Governor O'Malley, on the issues facing the American people, not Bill Clinton's personal behavior.
This is the final debate for the Democratic Party before caucuses are held in Iowa on February 1st. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
Coming up on International Edition, tricking our brains not to be tricked by politicians, and refugees rock, at least for the music industry. With the crowded U.S. field of candidates running for the White House, we've been getting a close look at politicians and their ways. But why do seemingly intelligent and well-educated people get duped by these fast talkers? To look at this issue, author Rick Schenkman has written the book Political Animals: How Our Stone Age Brain Gets in the Way of Smart Politics. And he joins us now on the line. Welcome, Rick.
Glad to be here.
Thank you. It's a cute title. Say, how do politicians fool us innocent voters?
Well, here's the basic problem. Most of the time in politics, as in life, what do we wind up doing? We go on our instinct. And what I argue in the book is that when you go on your instincts in politics, you're almost always making a wrong move. The reason is our brain was designed back in the Stone Age, a 2.5 million long period. It was designed to help hunter-gatherers address the problems of people living in the Stone Age. Today, we're living in a multicultural world that's complicated, involving not just 150 people in a small community, as was the case back then, way back then, but millions and billions of people. So our instincts aren't geared for the problems that we're facing, and it gets us into trouble in all sorts of ways.
Like what?
Well, for instance, we don't read politicians well. We see them on TV, and we think because we've seen them a couple of times and caught them here on a debate or maybe a 10-second clip on the news that we know them. We don't actually know them. The reason that we think we know them is because back in the Stone Age, it was advantageous for us to have a quick assessment of people and size them up to be able to understand whether they were going to be a threat to us or not. But in addition to that kind of knowledge, which is very important, it's good to have that kind of quick assessment, they had deep knowledge of the people around them because they were living with them. They were working with them. These communities, as I indicated, were only about 100 to 150 people large. So that means you really got to know people. When we see somebody on TV, we don't really know them at all. We're just catching a glimpse of them. But our brain convinces us that, oh, we really know this guy after just seeing him a couple of times. It's called the mere exposure effect, and it gets us into all kinds of trouble. So, for instance, for Republicans back in the 1970s and 60s and 50s, they really thought they knew who Richard Nixon was. He was around for decades. They thought they really got him. And, of course, in Watergate, we showed that they didn't really get them. And I was one of those people. I was a supporter of Richard Nixon in the tank for him all the way through Watergate, right up until 2 months before he finally resigned, long after many people had given up on him. But I stuck by him because I thought I really understood him and liked him. That's my albatross. for Democrats, the problem shows up, for instance, in people like John Edwards. When he burst on the scene, nobody really knew anything about him, but within 5 years of getting elected to the U.S. Senate from North Carolina, he was suddenly the vice presidential nominee of the Democratic Party. Wow. And why was that? Because people thought they knew him. Only later did we find out all the stuff involving his girlfriend and putting her on the campaign payroll and on and on. It went. So we have to second-guess ourselves, is what I argue in the book, when we're reading politicians, and we are perfectly capable of doing that. Just because our instincts lead us to conclude one thing or another thing doesn't mean that we're stuck with Stone Age politics, because we have higher-order cognitive thinking. We are capable of actually thinking. So all I argue is, don't go on instinct in politics. Actually put your brain to work, and you'll be able to come up with the right solution.
I appreciate you joining us today.
It was my pleasure.
This is VOA.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA Podcasts a try.
VOANews.com.
Visit our website at VOANews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA Podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Besides rising walls and closed doors, Europe's refugee crisis has also drawn a massive musical reaction, seen by the mushrooming concerts, albums, and charity singles to raise awareness and funds on behalf of the hundreds of thousands of Syrian, Iraqi, and Afghan asylum seekers. From Paris, Lisa Bryant takes a look at the charity music phenomenon.
Gaetan Ziga and his band are rehearsing for their next concert in a small studio in northern Paris. They're playing songs from his latest album. The English translation is Morning Dew. It explores the journey of asylum seekers, starting with the lead song, Refugee. The album has sold modestly, but Ziga says it's getting a good reception in the towns where he plays. 20% of the proceeds go to French charity Secours Catholique.
Nous sommes catholiques de Chartres.
Ziga says several hundred people attended a recent concert in the French city of Chartres, for example. Almost every family left with a CD. Ziga does not have to look far for inspiration. Immigrants from all parts of the world squat in tent camps around the city until authorities demolish them. Some include the wave of asylum seekers who have poured into Europe over the past year. The newcomers are getting a mixed reception, but not from the music world, where they're sparking a sort of artistic awakening. In Germany, where migrant men are among those blamed for New Year's Eve attacks, An old punk rock song against the far right recently made it back in the charts. Russian group Pussy Riot has released a tough new video demanding that European governments let refugees in.
Hello? We need some help here.
This is a disaster. There is no value for a human being. No value at all. Where's the humanity?
Another video released in Britain features a Crowded House song, Help Is Coming, played to haunting images of refugees, with UK actor Benedict Cumberbatch urging the world to respond. Help is coming. Proceeds from that video are going to Save the Children. Nicola Tano, who runs the charity's creative department, says it's raised tens of thousands of dollars, but that's only part of the payback.
The impact of something like the Help Is Coming single is as much public relations and getting people aware of the issue, getting people engaged, getting them emotionally involved, as it is the actual money that's raised.
A group that's never had any problems saying how they feel, you too.
The refugee music has a precedent. Remember Live Aid, that star-studded concert 30 years ago? It raised over $100 million for famine relief in Ethiopia, but it left a controversial legacy.
One of the legacies is that it's a way of saying the 80s wasn't all a selfish, greedy decade. Anyone who works closely with charity knows that Live Aid was not the perfect solution, knows that the money caused problems. There have been some scandals around where the money actually went.
Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
We would like to invite you to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at @VOA_IE. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
On the third Monday of each January, Americans honor the memory of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. Dr. King, a Baptist minister from the southern state of Alabama, was a leader in the U.S. civil rights movement, advocating social change through nonviolent means. On January 15th, he would have celebrated his 86th birthday. Believing that change does not roll in on the wheels of inevitability, but comes through continuous struggle, Dr. King organized and participated in mass action boycotts, sit-ins, peaceful marches, and other nonviolent acts of civil disobedience. Dr. King once stated that an individual who breaks a law that conscience tells him is unjust and who willingly accepts the penalty of imprisonment in order to arouse the conscience of the community over its injustice is in reality expressing the highest respect for the law. And so, activists sometimes deliberately, but peacefully and respectfully, broke laws aimed at segregating the white citizenry from the non-white, thus hoping to bring attention to the inherent unfairness of such legislation. Thus, when a black seamstress named Rosa Parks broke the law in Montgomery, Alabama, by refusing to give up her seat on a bus to a white passenger and subsequently was jailed for her transgression, her plight generated national attention and increasing sympathy for her cause across the country. Dr. King was 39 years old when he died by an assassin's bullet on April 4, 1968. But his legacy lives on. In the fullness of time, segregationist laws were repealed. Discrimination is a legally punishable and punished offense. And even as we celebrate Martin Luther King Jr.'s life and enormous contribution to society, Barack Obama, the first ever African-American U.S. president, begins his seventh year in office. I never thought in my lifetime that I would see one of us aspiring to be the head of our nation, said Martin Luther King Jr.'s eldest sister, Dr. Christine King Farris. Mr. Obama leading us toward the presidency is like the promised land for us. Dr. King's life is well summed up in his own words. The quality, not the longevity of one's life, is what is important.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
Hello.